Disrespect will take you places you can't get to from here. Disrespect entertains with a look at the challenges and sometimes the successes of people with disadvantages and disabilities who have had taken from them or have been denied the full choice of possibilities to affect for the better their own lives or the lives of those about them. Disrespect welcomes Dr. Ari Jaffe from Edmonton's Stollery Children's Hospital. He's a pediatric intensive care specialist, critical care specialist, and he's come to talk to us tonight about death by cardiac donation and the letter that he's co-authored with seven American physicians. How are you tonight?
I'm well, thank you.
Okay. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
How did that letter get started?
A group of us have been concerned about the practice of donation after cardiac death. It's also called donation after cardiocirculatory death. After discussing it amongst ourselves, we decided that we would put something together and write the letter to the journal Pediatric Critical Care Medicine.
Yeah, and it's been published, right?
Correct.
All right. How did you know each other beforehand? I mean, I guess obviously it's a close-knit group of specialists, but you were particularly close-knit and you were able to sense this affinity for one another in your beliefs.
Yes. Well, we work in different centers.
Right.
With some of my colleagues here in Edmonton, we have done a couple of surveys, one of university students and one of local pediatricians,
yeah,
asking them their opinions about the practice of DCD.
Right.
That's the abbreviation for the donation after cardiac death.
Right.
And we published those results, and one of the intensivists in the States had seen that and contacted me, and I had previous conversations with him about other things, but
okay,
we discovered that we were both interested in that practice and had similar opinions, so we decided each of us with our colleagues in our respective locales to work together and write the letter.
It sounds like it's a practice common to all of their locales. They're all familiar with it.
Yes. It's a practice that has been increasing in adult critical care,
yeah,
both in the United States and Canada.
Right.
And there is interest in certain groups to have it expand to children and to pediatrics as well.
So it does happen in pediatrics, but it's not that common yet.
Right. It definitely happens. It's not as widespread as in adults.
All right.
More so has happened in the United States, although there have been some cases in Canada as well.
I heard that you've suggested that the practice is... The same reasons for putting a moratorium on the practice apply to adults as to children, but as a pediatric intensivist, you've asked for the moratorium on children. You and your colleagues have asked for the moratorium on children. I guess part of that is because I have a hard time getting my head around the distinctions here because I'm not in medicine, but I guess that's because you're a pediatric specialist for one thing, and for another, because it's not yet widespread, you see a chance to to forestall something that you may be perceived at least as hasty and at best as misdirected?
Yes, I would agree with that. I think, you know, as specialists in pediatrics, and our practices are only to deal with children with critical illness,
right,
we felt that our expertise is more, you know, our expertise and training applies to children, and so we would not overstep our area of expertise.
Right.
I agree with you that I don't think the argument is different in children or adults, but we wanted to restrict our comments to our area of specialty.
Right.
And the second point is true as well, that DCD has been widely practiced in adults and is expanding to children, so
right,
it is not as... the debate in children is not as well established.
Right. Would children's... I'm just speculating now, but would children's capacity for growth and recovery, which outweighs that of adults, anecdotally, and there's probably studies to that effect too, would that have a bearing on your proposal? I mean, children have... It's been documented that children have recovered from the most horrific traumas that haven't injured them the same way as adults have, or if they have injured them, they have so much growth ahead of them that they've overcome them.
Right. You know, I guess my comment about that is it's hard to answer. I would say yes and no, and I'll explain
right,
that a
sure.
bit. I think that some of the issues that we raise are there has been less experience in children, meaning something called auto-resuscitation, which is the possibility of the heart restarting to pump and circulate blood after it has temporarily stopped.
Right.
The literature on that in children is much more limited than in adults.
Okay.
And something called the Lazarus phenomenon, which is where after a period of cardiopulmonary resuscitation, where unsuccessful resuscitation is stopped,
right,
and then minutes later the circulation restarts, although it is known to be to occur, although rarely, in adults. Literature regarding that in children is also much more limited.
Right.
So the question of whether those outcomes are different in children versus adults is an open question.
Right.
In terms of prognostication in children with severe injuries or underlying diseases, I think it's fair to say that we have less ability or less information, fewer numbers to prognosticate as compared to adults.
Right.
That enters into the whole discussion because our concern about conflicts of interest entering in the subjective decision whether it is time to stop life support or not. I think that is even more subjective in children than adults in many cases.
Because of the lack of data and
right.
predictive capability.
The reason I say yes and no is because it's often, as you said, anecdotally quoted that you know, after a brain injury, children seem to have more, some people say, plasticity of the brain
All right.
and ability to recover.
Right.
Although I don't know that that's true. There are a few recent studies that suggest that actually may not be true. So
really?
Some studies suggest that the younger child who has has a brain injury may have, in fact, less ability to compensate, and it's the older child and adult who have already acquired an ability like language or mathematics or other cognitive abilities where they have they're less likely to lose those, whereas the younger children may lose the ability to develop that. So, but that's getting a bit off topic.
You know, but only just, yeah.
Yeah. But I think that what you suggest is true, that there is less information in to help us prognosticate in critically ill children. Mm-hmm. So I think that enters into the equation in whether we should embark on DCD, because our subjective prognostication and decisions when to stop life support treatment are difficult enough on their own, and we worry that a conflict of interest may come into play when both parents and children and the physicians and healthcare team are aware that donation of organs is a possibility if we decide to withdraw life support.
Right.
And I just want to clarify with that, I'm not saying that the conflict is necessarily conscious. I don't think people should fear their physicians
have their organs.
Bad intent and intentionally would stop early.
But it makes the decision more difficult.
Right. It makes it more difficult, and a lot of our decisions have unconscious processes where we have biases that we're not aware of, and we worry that this may be one of those.
Yeah. Okay. And now we'll take a short break from our interview with Eric Bibb and Guru Man.
If I could know what to do and the right time to do it, when I lays around and when to get to it, mama, I'd be a true blue guru man. If I knew how to quit or when I'm ahead and stop acting like a crazy fool instead, mama, I'd be a true blue guru man. If I could know when to stop and leave the bottle alone, or when to grab my coat and go on home, I wouldn't be here in the courthouse now. When I can tip my hat and walk out the door without having that just one more, mama, I'll be a true blue guru man. What to do and the right time to do it, when I lays around and when to get to it, mama, I'd be a true blue guru man. I'm gonna tell the judge I went round the bend, gonna give him my word it won't happen again. One day I'll be a true blue guru man. Woo! Just set me free and I'll be a guru man.
You've been listening to Dr. Ari Jaffe of Edmonton Stollery Hospital discuss why he and seven other American physicians drafted and had published a letter calling for a moratorium on donation by cardiac death for children.
Who would establish such a moratorium? Physicians? And would it come from the physicians? Or would it come from an authority such as the AMA or the Canadian Medical Association?
That is a good question. We hadn't specified that. We were...
I guess you'd be glad to see it from anyone, but I'm just wondering if you had any insight into how it might be possible.
I think it would need to be something that comes from physicians. meaning that we are hoping that it would be a voluntary decision from critical care physicians that we should have more discussions about the pros and cons of DCD.
Right.
And also more discussions about how truly informed consent is when it does happen.
Yeah.
And seriously reconsider both those issues before institutions embark on doing pediatric DCD.
Yeah.
Whether it would need a medical organization to
codify it. Yeah.
I guess that would be ideal if the medical society, like say an American Academy of Pediatrics, or
yeah,
someone like the Canadian Critical Care Society, would say that we need to, you know, step back.
Right.
And reconsider some of these arguments before we decide whether to or whether not to embark on that.
Yeah. Well, so many questions came up in my mind while you were talking. Yeah, the issue of who would raise the issue, and unanimity or consensus, anyway, a substantial consensus among physicians would make it a lot easier. You have not got the same reservations about a brain a donation by brain death, right?
You know what? That's a separate question, and
all right.
You know, there, in my personal opinion, I'm not speaking for the other co-authors because
all right,
we did not address that. My personal opinion is there are problems with that as well.
All right.
I guess that's a good question. That should be a separate interview.
For sure. For sure. I understand through my own discussion of the medical issues that the donation issues revolve around the necessity of keeping someone alive until the donation, at least in some sense alive. Keeping the organs alive, let's put it that way, and that involves, to a certain degree, keeping the person alive.
Right. Well, maybe I should step back and describe what happens in DCD or what the process is.
Yeah, that would be helpful.
Right, because then I can briefly describe that and then summarize maybe the a couple of the main concerns that we have.
Sure.
Mentioned already, but it will help clarify those. Basically, you know, in donation after cardiac death.
All right.
In that scenario, what happens is, first, there is a patient, in this case a child,
mm-hmm,
who has had either a profound injury or underlying disease.
Right.
That has led to them requiring life support.
Right.
And the parents and the healthcare team facing the, you know, terrible decision that they have to consider whether it is time to stop life support and come off a ventilator,
yeah,
and allow the child to die.
Right.
And as hard as that is, sometimes that is a decision that is in the best interest of the patient.
Okay.
And so that's the first step, is, and usually that is a child who has had a very profound brain injury.
All right.
Or other organ dysfunction where the burdens of continued life support are felt to outweigh the benefits.
Yeah.
And that's the first step. Then
all right,
the second, if that decision is made,
right,
both, you know, by parents and the healthcare team, then a separate discussion is to happen, asking if the patient would donate organs after death is pronounced when their heart stops.
Right.
Okay, and if there is consent for that, then at a predetermined time, the life support is withdrawn, and the patient, may die, right? And if they die within the first 2 hours, then they can donate organs. So the final step is if their heart stops, the doctors wait anywhere from 2 to 10 minutes. It depends on the institution. Some, like in Pittsburgh, will say 2 minutes. In fact, there were a few cases in Denver where they waited 75 seconds. And other places will say they need to wait 10 minutes of absent circulation. And at that time, the physician will pronounce death. And then the surgical team will do surgery to obtain the organs, usually kidneys and possibly liver and lungs and rarely heart for donation. And that's the process. And so we have concerns at each of those steps with the process.
We'll be back next week with part two, the conclusion of our interview with Dr. Ari Jaffe of Edmonton's Stollery Children's Hospital, about why he and seven other American children's specialists issued a letter calling for a moratorium on donation by cardiac death for children. And now it's time for Disrespect's weekly review of the news. These aren't the articles we read to you. Those are in the papers that we identify during the broadcast. These are condensations, abbreviations, even teasers from the articles themselves. McMurtry's G20 review, just another liberal subterfuge. In June, Dalton McGuinty's liberals got in trouble because of some combination of misinformation and misdirection regarding the meaning of the 5-meter rule, affecting the International Summit Security Zone. 3 months later, they managed to achieve rather similar confusion as they announced their response to that controversy. On Wednesday morning, it appeared the government was taking some overdue responsibility. Roy McMurtry, a respected former Attorney General and Ontario Chief Justice, has been called in to conduct an independent review. Secret law probe ordered, blared a headline on the front page of the Toronto Star, which got wind of the announcement early. The widespread perception for a few hours was that Mr. McMurtry would be looking at why hadn't the government announced a change to the law that affected access to a large chunk of Toronto? Why did it allow the police to misrepresent the rule, leading Torontonians to believe they could be arrested for coming within 5 meters of the G20 security wall? And what responsibility did the government bear for the fact that at least a couple of people were arrested under a law that didn't really exist? That was until Community Safety Minister Jim Bradley emerged from the legislature to disappoint a large and expectant pack of reporters with the news that Mr. McMurtry's scope would be very narrow indeed. One way or another, Mr. McMurtry appears to have been used as a prop. The government seems to have wanted to give the appearance of responding to this summer's controversy without actually doing so. It was gamesmanship of one form or another. Ontarians might have got the impression that the Liberals were taking responsibility for their lackadaisical protection of civil liberties. For now, at least, that impression, like so many others around the G20, would be false. And that from Adam Radwanski in Thursday, September 23rd's Globe and Mail. Hospitals cutting services to hire lobbyists, opposition charges. The new Democrats raised in the legislature
that they found at least 14 hospitals have firms registered on the province's list of lobbyists. Four hospitals still have active lobbyists on the list. The party said the rest of the contracts ended over summer after NDP researchers started digging around. Only three hospitals were willing to say how much they spent, said NDP leader Andrea Horvath. Mississauga's Credit Valley spent $80,000. Brampton's William Osler with almost $78,000, and Tillsonburg District Memorial Hospital with $35,000. William Osler has cut operating room and emergency services, and patients at Credit Valley lost physiotherapy and dietitian services, Horvath said. Why are precious health care dollars being diverted to insider lobbyists instead of being used for doctors, for nurses, and for frontline care, she asked. McGuinty was quick to condemn the practice, but didn't say what steps he'd take to stop it. But opposition parties say the Liberals have been dragging their heels on hospital lobbying. Said Conservative health critic Christine Elliott, it's not good enough for them to shrug their shoulders and say, oh, we agree with the opposition. This is the wrong thing to do, she said. They're the government. They should put a stop to it once and for all. The NDP's list of hospitals that hired lobbyists include Toronto's Hospital for Sick Children, St. Joseph's Health Centre, Rouge Valley Health System, Lake Ridge Health, Joseph Brant Memorial, St. Thomas Elgin General, Royal Victoria in Barrie, Halton Healthcare System, Woodstock General, Vaughan Health Campus of Care, and Ottawa Hospital. And that from the Canadian Press. Privacy Commissioner finds evidence of abuse at Veterans Affairs. Canada's Privacy Commissioner says she's uncovered evidence of possible widespread privacy abuse at Veterans Affairs and decided on her own to launch a full-fledged audit into how the personal information of injured soldiers is handled. A statement by Jennifer Stoddard's office released to the Canadian Press contradicts Veterans Affairs Minister Jean-Pierre Blackburn. The commissioner has advised Minister Blackburn's office that her investigation into a complaint about the handling of one veteran's personal information has raised concerns about the possibility of systemic privacy issues, Valerie Lawton, a spokeswoman for Ms. Stoddard, said in a prepared statement. As a result, she had already decided to initiate an audit of the department's privacy practices. Mr. Blackburn made it sound as if he initiated the more comprehensive probe during a news conference to announce improved support for the families of the most severely wounded soldiers. The review will be undertaken when the commissioner finishes her investigation into a complaint launched by Sean Brugge, a retired forces captain and an outspoken critic of the department. His medical and psychiatric records found their way into a 2006 briefing note to former Veterans Affairs Minister Greg Thompson. NDP leader Jack Layton was astounded at the contradiction and said it's time for the Prime Minister to fire Mr. Blackburn. It's reprehensible, it's disgraceful, and this shows that this government has failed veterans very fundamentally, he said. News of the audit came less than a day after Veterans Ombudsman Pat Stogren, who suffers from an operational stress injury, revealed he wanted an investigation into the way bureaucrats may have used his medical records. He was responding to Mr. Brouillet's revelations. Mr. Brouillet said he's yet to receive the Privacy Commissioner's report into his case, but he felt vindicated by Ms. Stoddard's sense that the vendetta against him was part of a wider problem with the department. This is exactly the reason I brought my case to her and exactly the reason why I went public on it, Mr. Brouillet said. I believe this is reflective of a systemic problem, a moral rot in a system that needs to be thoroughly investigated. Legal experts have suggested the House of Commons Information and Privacy Committee investigate the matter. Mr. Brouillet, however, said Parliament is far too divided and partisan for such a probe. He's pushing for a public inquiry. That's bylined Canadian Press, but also Murray Brewster with The Globe, September 29th in Ottawa. Tories to offer more options to injured vets. The Harper government is caving into pressure from military groups and will allow injured veterans to spread out the payment of up to $276,000 that they receive after returning from combat. The lump sum payment offered to injured veterans was introduced in the Veterans Charter in 2005, replacing a monthly payment for life. While the government will not return to the old stipend for life, Veterans Affairs Minister Jean-Pierre Blackburn said he's set to offer more flexibility to injured veterans. The money will be available over a longer period, and the amount will continue to be indexed. Still, the government will continue to face criticism if it doesn't boost the amount that it offers to injured veterans. In an interview, NDP MP Peter Stauffer said that the British veterans get four times more money than their Canadian counterparts and that simply allowing recipients to spread out the money is not good enough. The announcement on changes to the lump sum payment has been pushed back to this week because of the swearing-in of the new Governor General, David Johnston. Veterans Affairs has other problems on its plate, particularly surrounding revelations that medical information of some veterans was shared among hundreds of people in the department. The government's announced a series of measures worth $2 billion for veterans in recent days, including $200 million over the next 5 years for those who can't go back to work because of their injuries. Mr. Blackburn said he wants to make it clear the government takes care of injured veterans and the services go well beyond the payment of up to $276,000 for a serious injury. We have to show our veterans, when they are seriously injured, don't simply receive the payment and are then left to fend for themselves, he said. Oh, and that was the Globe and Mail, Daniel LeBlanc in Ottawa, Thursday, September 30th. Ashley Smith's family can make case for open inquest. Diana Zlomislik in The Star. The family of Ashley Smith will be allowed to publicly make the case for a wide open inquest into the troubled teen's jail cell suicide. Ontario Coroner Dr. Benita Porter has delayed the November 1st start of the inquest and agreed to hold open hearings starting that day. Smith's family and other parties had told Porter it would be a mistake to limit the inquest to the time she spent in custody in Ontario. Smith strangled herself in October 2007 with a piece of cloth at Kitchener's Grand Valley Institution for Women, while guards, who were ordered not to intervene, watched. Earlier this month, Porter, the deputy chief coroner for inquests, had imposed a sweeping ban on all documents and discussion around the Smith family's motion to broaden the scope of the inquest. There were to be no public arguments. Her family, however, supported by prison and youth advocacy groups, argued Porter must consider Smith's entire time in custody. Porter said she would allow the family oral arguments as well as written and production of documents. She said she will rule on the motion by November 15th and tentatively set a new inquest date of January 10th, 2011. Challenging week. Some Mac students, faculty try food bank diet. This from The Spectator. Kimberly Pastrak drinks about 3/4 of a liter of chocolate milk every day. She also eats every 3 hours because she swims 5 days a week. Next week, she'll have to eat much less. Pastrak is starting the Do the Math Challenge. Has started on Monday with 66 other McMaster University students and some faculty members who are attempting to live off the contents of a food bank box for 5 days. The campaign was championed by the 25 and 5 Hamilton Network for Poverty Reduction. The food boxes are prepared by the university because they don't want to take resources from already depleted food banks in Hamilton, said Carol Wood, ecumenical chaplain and co-chair of the McMaster Community Poverty Initiative. Wood added they encourage participants to petition MPPs for a $100 per month increase for people receiving Ontario Works assistance. A week is a long time to try and do this diet, but people are doing this every day in Hamilton, and that's what we're trying to capture, said Jeff Wingard, the university's Poverty Initiatives Development Coordinator. Pastrak, who picked up her food rations Thursdays, admitted next week would be difficult. That made me realize people at a food bank don't have a choice. You can't afford to be a picky eater. Stuart Phillips, a McMaster kinesiology professor who examined the content of the food boxes, said the options were woeful from a nutrition standpoint. That box is going to be devoid of some essential nutrients, such as iron and zinc. It's very low on protein. Pastrak is going to be starving. She's going to lose weight, Phillips said. Hannah Abram, a first-year humanities student who is also taking up the challenge, said the lack of variety would be the biggest challenge for her. Both Abram and Pastrak are planning to eat a large meal this weekend before the challenge starts. And that from Danielle Wong at The Spectator. Ottawa urged to fund nationwide hearing tests for newborns. Speech and hearing experts are asking the federal government to establish a national program to test newborns for hearing problems, which often go undetected through the first years of life and can significantly impede learning and social development. The Canadian Association of Speech-Language Pathologists and Audiologists said on Monday that Alberta, Saskatchewan, Manitoba, and Newfoundland still do not require every baby to be tested. And if the problem's diagnosed early, the communication, socialization, learning, and behavioral issues that often result can be reduced or prevented. The federal government has often argued that health issues are the jurisdiction of the provinces and territories. But Andre Durio-Smith, a professor of audiology at the University of Ottawa, said all children in Canada should have access to the same tests. And that from the Globe and Mail, Tuesday, October 5th, bylined Gloria Galloway. And let's take a break with a deeply affecting song by Eric Bibb about life and death, Delia's Gone.
Christmas night, first time he shot, she hung her head and died. One more round, Delia's gone. One more round, Delia's gone. Sent for the doctor, doctor come too late. Sent for the minister to lay out Delia straight. One more round, Delia's gone. One more round, Delia's gone. Delia, oh Delia, where you been so long? Everybody's talking about you, now you're dead and gone. One more round, Delia's gone. One more round, Delia's gone. Tony shot his Delia one Christmas night. First time he shot, she hung her head and died. One more round, Delia's gone. One more round, oh Delia's gone. One more round, Delia's gone.
remove GST on home heating. Layton. NDP leader Jack Layton is turning the tables on the Harper government over taxes, calling on the Tories to show warmth to Canadians by removing the GST on home heating as winter approaches. And Layton is threatening to target Conservative MPs in Ontario and British Columbia in the next election for supporting the unpopular harmonized sales tax that went into effect in July. The tactics an ironic twist on Stephen Harper's successful use of the GST issue in his first campaign 4 years ago, when he rode to victory on the promise to cut the sales tax by 2 percentage points. Layton unveiled the ideas in a speech before the party's National Council in Ottawa and got enthusiastic cheers from the faithful for his efforts. During the address, Layton singled out the 44 Tory MPs from Ontario and 21 from BC, the two provinces that imposed the HST in July, who voted in favor of the new tax. This is his tax. It would not have happened without the Stephen Harper initiative, Layton said. He can run, but he can't hide from this one. A spokesperson for Finance Minister Jim Flaherty said the NDP has voted against and opposed every tax cut we introduced, including cutting the GST to 5% on every purchase Canadians make, including home heating. Trying to establish that the NDP is not the tax and spend party it is constantly accused of, Layton said the one tax he would cut immediately is the 5% GST on home heating. Layton said many Canadians haven't recovered from the recession and will be hard-pressed to pay for heating this winter, particularly since the HST has added to rising costs. He said energy costs in Ontario have risen 17% in the last 6 months. This is Canada. Home heating is a basic need. You shouldn't have to miss a meal or cut off your cable in order to be able to heat your home, he said. And that from the Spectator, bylined Canadian Press, but also reporter Julian Beltrame. The date, October 4th, Monday. Darlington upgrades could boost hydro rates. Critics slam McGuinty over soaring electricity bills and future energy costs. Hydro consumers could soon be zapped with another rate hike to pay for the refurbishment of the Darlington nuclear station. The Ontario Power Generation asked the Ontario Energy Board, which regulates the sector, permission to raise rates next March to finance the upgrades. OPG needs about $8.5 billion to $14 billion to extend Darlington's life for another 30 years. However, clean air advocates say every nuclear project Ontario undertakes goes over budget, and the real cost to fix Darlington could be between $21 to $35 billion. Asking the public to pay for Darlington could be the straw that breaks the taxpayers' back, said NDP MPP Peter Tabins, Toronto Danforth. In question period. Many Ontarians can't afford their hydro bills, said Tabins. This government is plunging ahead with the Darlington refurbishment, even though the costs are uncertain. Why is the government rolling the dice again on our hydro bills? The Progressive Conservatives accused the government of hiding a report on future energy costs. PC leader Tim Hudak said they've uncovered a letter from the Ontario Energy Board that says they have completed a study on how much future energy costs will rise. You have chosen to bury it, Hudak said to Premier Dalton McGuinty. You refuse to release the OEB study on how much rates are going to go up for Ontario families. What's with this secrecy? McGuinty did not acknowledge the report. Instead, he pointed to the Tories' flip-flop on energy policy and how Ontarians have no idea where the Conservatives stand on conservation. That from the Star, Tanya Talaga at the Queen's Park Bureau. And that was September 30th. Tuesday, September 28th, Spectator, Horizon Seeks Hefty Hike, by Steve Arnold. Horizon Utilities, which distributes power in two cities, Hamilton and St. Catharines is asking the provincial regulator to increase the distribution charge for power by almost 12%, effective January, and the utility says it will need to make more increases in the future. At the same time, provincial NDP leader Andrea Horvath has started a campaign to cut bills by getting the provincial government to remove its portion of the new harmonized sales tax. Tony Iavarone, Horizon's Director of Corporate Communications, said the rate increase is needed so the company can start the expensive process of training new apprentices and replacing aging poles and wires. A lot of this infrastructure was put in during the 50s and the 60s, he added. Iavarone noted the Horizon hike is really only 3.5% of a total hydro bill because Horizon's fees and charges only account for about 22% of the bill. The rest consists of charges imposed by Ontario Power Generation and other agencies. This isn't the first rate increase hydro users have faced this year. In May, the Ontario Energy Board slapped average users with an increase of $5.78 to raise money for renewable generation projects and conservation programs and to meet increased costs for existing generation. And that was in addition to new time-of-use charges. In July, Ontario's new harmonized sales tax was added. Ontario Power Generation, the agency that actually produces electricity, has also applied for an increase of $2.75 per customer to take effect in January. The Ontario NDP has said the HST adds about $11.25 a month to the average bill. In total, the increases add up to more than $23.55 a month. For NDP leader Andrea Horvath, that's a cruel burden to lay on people already struggling because of fixed incomes or other problems. She's launched a campaign to push the Ontario government into taking its portion of the HST off hydro bills. This government has been putting more and more expenses on people who are already near the breaking point, Horvath said in an interview. This is going to drive people to the absolute brink of distress. In the legislature, Premier Dalton McGuinty said his party is working to help people manage electricity costs, but wouldn't promise to provide an HST exemption. And that again from The Spectator, Tuesday, September 28th. Globe and Mail, Tuesday, September 28th, Ontario to give seniors a break on hydro bills by Karen Howlett. Tax credit to help offset cost of power. You pay lots of taxes, right? So you'll save lots of money. The Ontario government, under siege over rapidly rising electricity prices, plans to roll out new tax relief measures for senior citizens to give them a break in their hydro bills, sources say. Premier Dalton McGuinty made the announcement at Kensington Gardens, a long-term care home in Toronto, according to government sources. Finance Minister Dwight Duncan unveiled the legislation for the tax credit later in the day, sources said. The government is grappling with the soaring cost of hydro amid worries that it will become an issue in next year's provincial election. The government plans to amend existing legislation known as the Ontario Energy and Property Tax Credit. The legislation was introduced in this year's budget and currently provides energy and property tax relief to low and middle income residents of the province. The government is also looking at giving consumers a break on hydro prices under a program that critics say is not living up to its promise to save electricity users money and promote energy conservation. Ontario is the first province in Canada to introduce time-of-use pricing designed to encourage consumers to run appliances during periods of lower demand. But under the current system, Mr. McGuinty has acknowledged that rates might not be low enough in off-peak hours to allow consumers to reap savings. And that, again, was Globe and Mail, Tuesday, September 28th. The byline, Karen Howlett. Tories won't adopt Senate plan to fight poverty. The Harper government has refused to adopt any of the 74 poverty-fighting recommendations that were part of a sweeping Senate report on homelessness and poverty. Instead, the government's response to the Senate's 300-page report was a 20-page list of Ottawa's current programs and a commitment to take the committee's recommendations under advisement as it continues to find ways to help Canadians succeed. Liberal Senator Art Eggleton, whose subcommittee on cities authored the report, said he is disappointed in the government's response. Anti-poverty groups were also disillusioned. With the majority of provinces and territories pursuing poverty reduction, the federal government needs to do its part, said Laura Rothman of Campaign 2000, a national coalition that's been pressing Ottawa to live up to its 1998 all-party resolution to end child poverty by 2000. The Senate report, In From the Margins, A Call to Action on Poverty, Housing, and Homelessness, says a staggering 3.4 million Canadians are trapped in poverty by government social programs that are substantially broken. The report also recommends developing a national income support program for the disabled, increasing the national child benefit to $5,000 by 2012, and boosting the working income tax benefit so those in low-wage jobs can escape poverty. The Senate adopted the report in a unanimous vote April 29th. That was from The Star, Lori Monsabraton, social justice reporter. And Between Smallville and Syria, A Superhero for the Times by Edith M. Lederer in New York for the Associated Press. A Muslim boy in a wheelchair with superpowers. The new superhero is the brainchild of a group of disabled young Americans and Syrians who were brought together in Damascus by the Open Hands Initiative, a nonprofit organization founded by U.S. philanthropist and businessman J.T. Snyder. The superhero's appearance hasn't been finalized, but an early sketch shows a Muslim boy who lost his legs in a landmine accident and later becomes the Silver Scorpion after discovering he has the power to control metal with his mind. Sharad Devarajan, co-founder and CEO of Liquid Comics, whose company is now turning the young people's ideas into pictures and a storyline, said the goal is to release the first comic book, Launching the Disabled Muslim Superhero, in early November in both Arabic and English. Mr. Snyder says he was inspired by U.S. President Barack Obama's effort to reach out to the Muslim world in his 2009 inaugural address. Last month, Mr. Snyder flew 12 disabled Americans to Damascus to meet their Syrian peers, and one of their main goals was to come up with new ideas and storylines for the new superhero. Each of their ideas was so originally distinct, whether the Syrian kids or the U.S. kids, he said, adding that perhaps because of their disabilities, the young people think as individuals without being influenced by outsiders. Mr. Devarajan said it was noteworthy that none of the young people wanted the hero's power to be something that cured their disability. They were empowered by their own disabilities, and they should not be seen as a source of weakness, he said. And A Smile for You. Oh, that, by the way, was from the Globe and Mail. A Smile for You from the Globe and Mail on Thursday, September 23rd. From Why We Are Laughing, A Book of Jokes by the Scottish Dementia Working Group. A couple in their 90s was having trouble remembering things. That night, the old man got up and asked, "Want anything while I'm in the kitchen?" "A bowl of ice cream, please." "Okay. Don't you think you should write it down?" she asked. "No, I can remember it. Well, I'd like some strawberries on top, too. Maybe you should write it down?" And irritated, he said, "I don't need to write it down." After about 20 minutes, he came back and handed her a plate of bacon and eggs. She stared at it for a moment and demanded, "Where's my toast?" And an elderly couple was having dinner at their friend's house, and afterward the wives went into the kitchen, leaving their husbands to talk. "Last night," one said, "we went to a new restaurant, and I'd recommend it highly." "What?" the other asked. "Was its name?" The first man thought a long while, then asked, "What is the name of that flower you give to someone you love? You know, the one that's red and has thorns." "Do you mean a rose?" "Yes," he exclaimed and turned toward the kitchen. "Rose," he yelled, "what's the name of that restaurant we went to last night?" And that's all the news for Disrespect this week. Come back next week. You know, there will be more. And to take us out, Eric Bibb one more time with an upbeat number, Pockets.
I got a pocket for my keys, pocket for my cash, one for my ticket, in case I got to leave town fast. My favorite pocket, you know the one I'm thinking of, is the pocket in my heart for your love. The pocket in my heart for your love. I got a pocket for my pen, one for my book, pocket for my glasses when I got to get a better look. But my favorite pocket, said it from the start, is the pocket for your love inside my heart. The pocket for your love inside my heart. Before I met you, baby, I had a pocket full of cares. Last time I looked, there wasn't any there. I got a pocket for my comb, pocket for my candy bar, one for my passport when I'm traveling that far. But my favorite pocket fits just like a glove, it's the pocket in my heart for your love. The pocket in my heart for your love. Since I met you, baby, I've been having so much fun writing love songs, and this one's almost done. I got a pocket for my watch, a pocket for my silver flask, one for my wallet with the family photographs. And my favorite pocket, said it from the start, is the pocket for your love inside my heart. The pocket for your love inside my heart. I got a pocket for my cough drops, pocket for my handkerchief. Before I gave it up, I had a pocket for my spliff. And my favorite pocket, you know the one I'm thinking of, is the pocket in my heart for your love. The pocket in my heart for your love. Talking about love pocket. Love pocket. I got it. Love pocket.
If you can't access a Disrespect broadcast, you can now listen to the show wherever you're near an internet download. Disrespect is archived at www.radioforall.net. That's the number four, not the word, radioforall.net. You can find the shows under its name, Disrespect. Tune in at showtime to see if something more topical hasn't displaced the show that we planned. Disrespect is digitally edited,
from live telephone and studio interviews.